Please welcome Larry from Seal Beach.
Hey everybody, my name is Larry Thomas. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank this group for having me come out here and be with you guys. And congratulations to all the chip takers and the birthday people, and especially the new ones. I'm here to tell you new guys that my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober a little over 41 years and not amount to a damn thing. So you're on the right track, young man. I'm here to tell you that I hope that you find something here that makes you come back, like they said before tonight. And I'm glad you're here. My life is my fault. I have no one to blame for me being here. I am the culprit. I'm the one that did it. And if you're new, I know there's something about you. I know there's something really keen about you. That there's some things that you've held in your head that have happened to you over your life, whether it be one incident or several, and you can't tell anybody about it. And these things keep you up at night. These keep you people from dodging people and having decent conversations, and they just haunt you. And I'm here to tell you that I hope you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to hear somebody share from this podium or any other podium who kind of scratches the surface of some of those secrets. And I'm here to tell you, I hope you find that person and saddle up with them and start coughing up some of those secrets. And I'm here to tell you, the truth about Alcoholics Anonymous is simply this, that no matter what those secrets are, no matter how disgusting or how torturous they were, you will not shock the people in AA. Yep, if it hasn't been done by the people in the first two rows over here, it just hasn't been thought of yet. You know what I mean? If you want to shock the people in AA, get a job in the meeting. Just shock the hell out of them, man. It did my sponsor, that's for sure. I was born in Detroit, come out to California when I was about 6 years old. My mom and dad were beautiful people. They had some trouble. They had a divorce, so they put me in a convent and then an orphanage for a while. And then several years later, they got together and they decided to come to California. And then they got out here and they said, well, we better go back and get him, you know. And so they picked me up out of there and brought me to California. And they were great people. My mom and dad were great people, hardworking, hard loving people, you know. And my mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and mom loved diet pills. So she was always running around the house around midnight, you know, or sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage around 4 in the morning, you know, just a busy lady, you know. And no matter what time you got up, she was up doing something, you know. And she used to love to eat that speed and make these huge afghans. And everything in the house had fresh afghans on it. Chairs had afghans, couches had afghans. You know, if my dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads she knit, you know. If we had any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And just a busy lady, you know. And no matter what time you got up, she was up doing something, you know. And she had this little room, and one of her favorite hobbies was to eat that speed and make these huge jigsaw puzzles. Not the 4,000 piecers or the 8,000 piecers, but the 1 million piecers, you know, of the Mojave Desert. You know what I mean? Yeah, this would excite her. You know, it's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know, and she'd get all excited, you know, and run down to the drugstore and get her stinky peroxide she used to put on her hair, you know, and she used to smoke these cigarettes called Raleigh cigarettes. And on the back of each pack of cigarettes was a coupon. And if you save all the coupons, they had a catalog and you could buy stuff. And she would buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And she would run to the house, put that stinky peroxide on her hair and start smoking those Raleighs, you know, and start putting together this puzzle. And she would stay planted until that thing, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 days, you know, making that puzzle. And if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers and she just snipped that son of a bitch down and wedge it right in there, you know. There was no stopping Betty, you know what I mean? She was going to finish that thing, man. And I loved her to death. Loved her to death, man. You know, my mom was a beautiful looking lady. She looked like that old actress, Kim Novak. And everybody loved Betty. Everybody, Betty had a personality. Betty was outgoing. Betty was friendly. Betty always had people around her and stuff like that. And I never want to forget what it was like to be 30 years old and finally come to you people for what I hope and pray is the last time, and what I'd done to that precious little lady. How I took that beautiful little lady and whittled her down to 95 pounds, where she was stuck in front of a kitchen window day in and day out. And all she did is look out that window and smoke those Raleighs, and wondering if the cop car that went by had her baby boy in there. Wondering if that newspaper that's coming under the door, is that got his obituary? And staying there at night, so is that my son walking down there in the middle of the night? Is that my son? My drinking ain't bothering anybody. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it was like to be 18 years old and be put away for a small period of time. And when you get out, the bus pulls up in front of the courthouse, and everybody's supposed to go out and go into the courthouse and the probation department, and whatever. And so there's about 40 of us chained together. And we start going over there. They let us loose. And I run into Gardena. Now it's a Monday and I come back on a Thursday. And I don't come back to court. I don't come back to the house. I come back to my mom's place of business. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. It's raining out. I'm standing in a parking lot. And I'm about from here to those back doors. And I'm hiding behind a parked car with that rain hitting me, waiting for that last customer to come out of this dry cleaners. She worked at a dry cleaners and she cleaned people's houses. And I was ashamed of her and I made fun of her. But I wasn't too ashamed to show up unannounced one more time with my bare feet, my filth, my needle marks, my wine sores, and what Wino Joe used to call the habiliments of despair. And I'm standing in that parking lot waiting for that customer to come out of there. And that customer comes out of there. And I start walking through that rain with my bare feet, man, like it was yesterday. And I've got one thought. She better have a buck. And I walk through that rain and I see that customer come out. I open up that glass door. That brass bell hits that glass door. And my mom turns around and makes that oh so familiar sound. Oh my God, where you been? And she goes over and she grabs her wallet. And she pulls out her wallet. And a picture of me falls out when I'm about 8 years old. And I'm on a Little League team. And that would be the only decent picture that she would ever have of me until I meet you folks. And I walk by that lady and she goes through her wallet and gets $1 and $2 and $3. And I run by her and I grab that money and I head back into Wilmington where I'm gonna die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any length is I need to ask you new guys something. How come when my life depends on it, you take this same man and stick me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? With my so-called desperation, I need to ask you new guys something. How come when my life depends on it, and make no mistake it will, how come I can't walk that same distance in that parking lot and walk that same distance and ask the secretary of this meeting for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life? And if I can find that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found the key to life. I will have found the key to life. If I could sit with you in that book and find that thing that keeps me from serving the place that I want so much from, I will have found the key to life. There's a miracle here. Something happens to the selfish and the self-centered people like myself, the something for nothing guy, when they find out what happens to you when you start serving something you want. And I do that, and I tell you that, and that's why I have a home group and a sponsor and a job in every meeting that I go to. And it's for one reason and one reason only. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what I used to be like and what's happened to me and what I'm like today. And if I can sit with you folks and study that book and put it to my life, I will have found the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. How many times do we come here in Alcoholics Anonymous and we sit in these meetings and month after month, we wonder why we ain't feeling like they're talking about. That's because you haven't applied that book to your life. It's more than just something to sit and get. You can do that anywhere. But when you start putting these things to your life, if we are, watch that, what the most powerful word in that book for me is the smallest word. It's called if. Notice that when you read that book, when you see that if, pay attention to that sentence. If we are painstaking through this certain, if we are, if we don't do these things, we are bound to get drunk. See, these are the hidden promises to the alcoholic of my type. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. The old man loved to get drunk and sneak into his own home. It was an amazing thing. He was a window climbing alky, which I believe is a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous. That old guy standing on that gas meter all night, pounding on that window, hoping that it's his own home, getting ready to make that magic dive over that toilet, over that sink, you know. And dad was a refinery worker, so he was always coming home on different hours, you know. You never knew when he was coming home, man. And one night, man, he sneaked into that bedroom of mine, and that old boot came down on my chest, you know, and I grabbed that boot, and I said, hey, Pop, I said, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? You know, shit, I hear the Hoover going now, you know, she's up anyway, you know. She could probably, you know, make a key with her little teeth, you know. And I tell you, me and my dad were all right till I was about 10 years old. At about 10 years old, I couldn't handle it anymore. I couldn't handle the yelling and the screaming and the hitting and the flesh hitting flesh and all that. And I had a hard time trusting the people that I loved. And it was hard to pick and choose when they were telling the truth. And I felt so guilty about that because I know they worked so hard. And I started running away from home at about 10, 11 years old because I felt more a part of life underneath the streetlight than my own dinner table. And I don't know why that was. I don't know why that was, but I started climbing out the window, he was climbing in, you know. And, you know, I tell you, I did an inventory when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things that I dragged through my entire life was the guilt that I had growing up. It seemed like I was born with it. I just didn't get it when I was 15. It just seemed like I was dragging that around. And what happened to me is, I felt so guilty that I wasn't able to stop the sounds that were scaring me. I felt so guilty that I couldn't stop them. And I felt so weak. And I didn't grow up thinking about being a baseball player or a drag racer driver. I grew up with one thing in mind, that one of these days I'm going to get it eye to eye with him and let him have it. I'm going to let him have it. And that was my goal. At 11 years old, there's four of us in a garage. And we start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. My little friend Luis Sanchez brought over some Four Rose whiskey. We started passing that little bottle. I'm 11 years old. I'm taking a hit off that, and I'm throwing up stuff I ate when I was 6 months old, for God's sake, you know. I mean, it cleaned me out, you know. And eventually during the night, I was able to hold some down, and Man, I remember I never laughed so hard in my entire life, man. It was on. And for those 6 hours, man, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I remember walking home and me and Louie were just laughing and falling into bushes and stuff like that. And I finally got home and I snuck into the house and noticed that Dad's car was gone, that he wasn't home. So I was able to go into my bedroom, and I went into my bedroom and I fell back on the bed, and the bed took off like a flying saucer, man, you know, whipped me around and knocked me out till the next morning. I got up that morning and I thought, oh my God, he's going to light me up, man. He damn near sawed my arms off for smoking. He's just going to set me on fire, man. You know, and I poked my head out there and the car was still gone. Dad was still gone. So I thought, you know what? Across the hall, he had a small room in there and he built himself a bar. And I thought, man, I know he's got some Thunderbird in there. So I got into his little bar and I snuck in there, man. And it wasn't a bar like, you know, where you can line up 30 guys, you know what I mean? He made a bar. It was an alky bar. It fit one guy. It was like a podium, you know. It had his little pickles pig feet there, you know, and he had his own whiskey and stuff like that. And I went to open it up and there was a lock on that thing about the size of a big book, you know. He knew who was down the hall, you know. But I started thinking about that night before. I started thinking about that night and that Four Rose whiskey last night. Now, I'm 11 years old. Now, I grew up knowing that I was a nobody. I knew it. Nobody had to tell me and convince me. I knew I was a loser. Knew it. I had no hope. You know, I had this, you know, I had this sloth about me, this laziness, you know. And, you know, I would do average things expecting standing ovations. You know, I take out the trash and I thought Mom and Dad were going, oh, shit, look at that kid go, you know. And to this day, I still have that, you know. I put on a toilet seat for my precious little wife about 5 years ago. And, you know, God, I was so, you know, I'm a plumber at trade. So I got her that, I remember Rosie, I got her this beautiful maple toilet seat with brass fittings, man, and carry that thing in there, you know, and put on this toilet seat for my wife and bolted it down and waited that night for her to come home because we're busy in A like you guys, you know, and we do some stuff and then we lay down and watch TV, you know, and I'm laying in the bed and she's in the bathroom, you know, and I'm like, God, she's got to notice it, man. She's been in there. It's going to be so great, man. You know, she comes out of the bed, doesn't say a thing, right? Just goes to bed and turns on the TV. And I thought, well, maybe she didn't notice that she's busy, you know, and maybe tomorrow. Well, this goes on for week after week, you know, and after about the second month, she comes waddling out of there, you know. And I said, hey, I says, you know, that's a brand new piece of wood you've been sitting on in there, you know. Who do you think put it on? God, you know. Old Lawrence of Torrance bolted that baby on there, you know what I mean? And she goes, oh, yeah, it's loose, too. You know, it's like, where's the gratitude in these women these days, you know? So anyway, you know, I knew I was a nobody, you know. But what I realized about that night is that for the first time in my life, this little nobody felt like somebody for 7 hours. And man, I was on top of the world and I didn't have to study for it. I didn't have to take a quiz for it. It was in that bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And man, I didn't become upset. I'm 11 years old. I didn't start hitting the bars, you know what I mean? Lose my paper out and come to AA, you know? But I become preoccupied with doing it again, you know, grabbing the guys and getting another bottle, you know what I mean? And the older I got, the more I did it, you know? I'm about, 13 years old, 14 years old, and there's a guy down the street who's into drag racing, and I go walking by his place, and I stop and watch him for a while, and we start talking, and he has guys working on his dragsters, and he says, hey, you know what a crescent wrench is? I said, yes, sir. He says, well, go over there and get me two of them, and I started chasing tools for this guy, and I found a little passion of mine, man, going to the drag races, and wanting to go fast and being a part of something, you know. And by the time I got into high school, man, People were going to their locker room. I'm freshman in high school. People are going to their locker rooms to get their books and notebooks. And I'm going to my locker room to get a little shot of Thunderbird and take some barbiturates, you know. And I started dating this little Mexican girl named Lupi. And she had some brothers, and they liked cars. And I love cars to this day. You know, I didn't have these Dodge trucks like you guys have out here with these 9-foot tires that you drive over each other's houses on the weekend. You know what I mean? But I did have a 62 Chevy Impala dropped right down to the ground. It had my hair slicked back and puffed up. It had a white T-shirt with black khaki pants that came up to here. And had a little girlfriend named Loopy, and she used to curl her hair with these soup cans, you know, and noodles were stuck in there, you know. And we'd drive around all night drinking that Thunderbird wine, listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye. God, I loved it, man. Not too long ago, I'm in my plumbing truck and the Four Tops come on, and hell, I just start sinking in my damn truck, man. You know? I loved it, man. Her sisters were telling her that men who are well endowed had big feet. So I went out and bought me a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know, and had my big hair and my big feet, you know, and I loved it, man. You know, Ryan tripped over my foot tonight and I felt proud, you know. And I loved it, man. And me and Pooch and Loopy, I thought we were going to bounce off into the sunset forever, man. And we started doing those little things and those little nickel and dime robberies and getting into people's houses and stuff like that, you know. And I loved it. Around 1969, people are going different places. I thought, where am I going to go? And I thought, man, I'm stuck in California. I said, I know what I do. I'll grab my dope dealer and go to Detroit and find my roots. So we bounced off to Detroit. Wound up in Phoenix, over off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel, man. 5 floors up, everybody's got a TV. It's down the hall, you know, a bathroom down the hall. Everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. It's about $12 a night, you know, and I'm running out of dough. I'm afraid to leave that place in the daytime. I'm afraid to be by myself at night. So I need to find a watering hole down there, and I find this place called the Wagon Wheel Bar, about 2 blocks down there. And the Wagon Wheel is a beautiful place. There's no windows. It's just a dirty curtain blowing through a doorway, you know. And I go in there and I meet a guy named Ernie. Now, every bar has an Ernie. Ernie's the answer man. No matter what's your problem, Ernie's got the answer. And it's usually in his trunk. And Ernie says, you need a job, you know. He says, come back here in the morning and I'll get you a job. So I come back early in the morning and he introduces me to a plumber. Well, I've never plumbed a thing in my life, you know. I've never worked before in my life. And, you know, the closest to plumbing I've ever been is throwing up in a toilet. That's about it, you know. And so he introduces me to this plumber and he takes me out in the desert and he sticks me underneath the house. And he says, and I got a transistor radio, I got a pint of PM bourbon. And he says, all I want you to do, hotshot, is hang copper. That's all I want you to do under here. You know, I'll be back in 8 hours to see how you're doing. And he took off. Now, if there's any place that I love being, is in your home. I don't care if it's under it, in the attic, in front of a medicine chest, a mirror. I don't give it, you know. When there's something about a strange home that I love, and I'm underneath this house, I'm underneath the house, right? And I'm excited because you never know what you're going to find under there, right? So he leaves me and I start crawling around. I don't crawl around for more than 5 minutes and I make the discovery. I'm crawling around and oh my God, there it is. It's a stray cat. Oh my God, this is great. I almost start crying, man. I mean, this is unbelievable. You know, I've got a transistor, I got a pint, I got a pet, you know, and I think, you know, this is the closest to normal living I'll get till I meet AAers, you know. And I get all excited, man. I start drinking that bourbon and crawling around and I bust up through the lady's floor. I rob her of her jewelry and some of her money, go back down, hang some more copper and bust open again and drink and steal some money and stuff. About 8 hours later, my boss is over there and he's dragging me out from underneath the house because I'm passed out. And this cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, you know, puts me in jail for 6 months. I get out of there. They send me back to California. No, before that, I go back to the watering hole. I go back to wagon wheel one more time, and Ernie says, "Here's what we're going to do." He says, "Not too far from here is a horse track." He says, "I'm going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey." I said, "Oh, this is great, man. I'll start working out and stuff." He said, "No, I don't know about that." He says, "But I need you to take this stuff. And in 2 months," he says, "I'm pretty sure you'll be down to 95 pounds. We'll go weigh you in and get our colors." And he leaves me in that little room with this powder. Now, up to this time, I've just been minding my own business, you know, drinking some wine and whiskey and doing some heroin, just minding my own business. I ain't bothering nobody, you know what I mean? And he leaves me with this powder. And I, you know, he comes back not 2 months, but he comes back 2 weeks later, right? Opens up the door and I'm just standing there. He says, "My God, you couldn't have possibly taken it." "Well, I did. I mean, you put a saddle on me and ride my ass around." I've been locked up in that little room for 2 weeks chasing flies around there, you know, and looking out the window every 10 seconds going, "What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that?" You know, or you can find me underneath the bed, scared to death, full of fear, just shaking because there's these black and white flashes that are just scaring the crap out of me. And it was the sun coming up and down, you know what I mean? "Oh my God, there it is again," you know. He goes, "Oh man." So he canned that idea, and then I went back to work for another plumber for about 2.5 hours. And I found out that he was younger than me, and, you know, I've got my Detroit pride. I ain't working for no kid. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. So they took me to the Phoenix County Hospital, and the doctor comes in there and looks at me, and I give him a 20. And he writes me a prescription for Percodan. And then he leaves the room. And on my way out, I see that he left a cardboard box full of blank prescription pads he wanted me to have. But I took that thing, man. I'm running down North Central. I ducked into the wagon wheel. Ernie says, "This is great. This is great." He makes a phone call to some guy in Yuma, Arizona. And we got a PDR book, and we start writing prescriptions and selling them. We're writing prescriptions for everything, man. Secanol, Nembutal, Tuinol, you name it all. Wrote it all, you know. Oh, yeah, damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me. And when you're loaded on barbiturates and whiskey, there's no freeway chase on Channel 5, you know what I mean? I was going 9 miles an hour, and the cop was on foot. He was just walking by going, "Hey, roll that window down. Come on, roll that window down, man." I'm looking at that guy going, "Can this man run or what?" You know what I mean? He threw me out of that car. They put me in jail again. I come out of there. And I'm over at the Harbor General Hospital in Torrance, California, on a gurney with an arm and a leg tied down. They found me somewhere. And the doctor comes over by the foot of the bed. And he says, "Son, it seems to be by the way you've been living that you need to be put away and observed for 30 or 60 days so we can find out what's emotionally and mentally wrong with you." And so they put me in a little bus and sent me to a little place where they're going to observe me. And a year later, they let me out, totally observed. They gave me the Thorazine to take and stuff like that. And in 1975, they find me on Overo Street, across the street at a Chevron gas station on a pile of tires, 125 pounds. At this time in my life, my route is from Broadway and Alameda, from Long Beach to downtown LA. That's all I do. And there is no invisible line of what a person does or doesn't do. And that was my walk to death. And I'm on this pile of tires, and I'm not over there vaping. I'm over there just to get out of the job. And I'm laying on these tires in 1975. And the cops come and get me and arrest me for being a public drunk, public nuisance, out-of-state forgery, violation of probation, and sentence me to 2.5, 3 years in a penitentiary. They roll me up, send me up to Wayside, and I'm up there waiting for the trial and everything like that. And about 3 months, they put 40 of us in a black and white bus, send us down to the South Bay Courthouse where I'm going to be tried and convicted. We get off that bus and we're in a holding tank about the size of this room. And one by one, all these guys are getting called out and they're not coming back. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one there. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now. Because they're always sending me somewhere. Now, isn't that the solution to people who don't know what's wrong with us? From the time I was 13 till the time I was 30, well-educated people, well-meaning people, people of the cloth, people of the law, people of medicine, well-meaning people have been intensely drawn to do one thing that they thought was the answer: separate him from alcohol. If we could just separate this guy from alcohol, he'll be all right. All he needs to do is be separated from alcohol. But little do they know that to alcoholics of our type, sobriety drives us to drink time and time and time again. And they don't get that. What happens to the alcoholic of our type is, no matter how desperate we are, and we get desperate, we don't want to live that hell again. And we wake up and see the habiliments of despair and loved ones and the blood and people crying. We know that. We don't want to do that again, but yet we lack the power to stop it. Why is that? Because the longer we stay sober, the less desperate we get. And if we don't replace desperation with inspiration, we're a dead man. And that's why it's so important when you read that book, if you're new, find out what you got. You don't have a disease. You don't have alcoholism. You don't have a state of mind. You know what I mean? The book says this: we are in the grip of a progressive illness. You don't have it. It has you. You're in the grip. And you'll be there for a lifetime. And the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous will do for you, if you put the book to test, is loosen up the grip. It won't get rid of the bat. It loosens up the grip just enough for you to be inspired by the results of you doing these steps. Especially every one of them.
Tell me.
Every one of them.
Tell me.
Every one of them.
Me.
And if you could just replace that desperation with inspiration, you've got a chance of the good life. And I didn't know that. I had no idea. When I was 2 weeks sober, a man stood behind the box like this and said the magic words for me that I hold dear today. Today, when I think of sobriety, the idea of drinking and using doesn't enter my mind. When I think of sobriety, I think about the way I live. Now, how many of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we stop drinking, and we try to squeeze our old way of life into these rooms? We want to be sober in AA, but we want to live the way we used to live. We're not willing to change anything. We just want to sit and get. And for people like me, it's just a matter of time when that obsession to drink will come back. That's why I've got to be sober when I take these steps, so that I can have the full effect of what's supposed to happen as a result of these steps after you take them. I had no idea. In 1975, in that holding tank, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now, because they're always sending me somewhere. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I heard the most beautiful sound a guy like me can hear. The sound of some keys coming down the hall, those heavy jailer keys. And there's a Scottish man, the old sheriff opened up that jail door, and there's a Scottish man with a patch standing there. And he's clean and he's sharp, just like you guys. And he's standing there with this grin and this patch. I laugh. He says, "You're peeing behind the podium." He says, "I lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "That's great." He says, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA." I said, to myself, AA, What's AA? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA? And who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? And looking back well over 50 years, I know exactly what he is because this room is sprinkled with him. It's called a trusted servant. He had no business being there. He wasn't part of a panel. He wasn't part of H&I. This man got the worst news of his life, and that was his wife was dying immediately of a terminal illness, and he took off driving. And then the thought came to him, maybe I could work with other alcoholics. Practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking but intensive work with other alcoholics. This works. And he thought about that. He turned his car around. He went to the South Bay Courthouse. He talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth. They looked at each other and they said, we got a guy for you. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch, right? He takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rolls up to this dingy, stinking, rotten, filthy, perverted Torrance Lamita Alano Club, right? What the hell is an Alano anyway? What kind of word is that? Is that like an elk or a moose, right? Watch for crossing Alanos, you know? And he pulled up to the Alano Club, and there's all the Alanos walking around, man. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo. He starts introducing me to all these goofy people, Indian Genie and Captain Bill and Tennessee Bob and, you know, Singing Sam, Serenity Sam, Bicycle Ray, Santa Claus, Dancing Pete, Whistling Butt, all these people, man. Little Moose was 150 years old. She comes running after me. She goes, oh, hi, honey. She says, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are. I said, you know, I said, I'm not it, you know. And this big transvestite starts circling me like a helicopter in Long Beach. And about his third time around, he comes walking up to me with his new moo-moo, and he goes, hi. He says, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. I said, I don't think so, big guy, you know. Not till I get my year, you know. And I said, my God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of it, man. If that's the effect of that big blue book, I don't want to crack that thing open either. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of your meetings of alcoholics. I hadn't touched AA. I did what I've been doing my entire life. I sat in a chair waiting for you to do something for me. That's something for nothing guy, right? Give me that pint, I'll pay you later. Give me that bag, I'll give you your dough later. Give me that peace of mind you have, I'll do this stuff later. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm here to tell you, if you come here to get anything, there is nothing to get in AA. Nothing. Look around you, for God's sake. You know what I mean? There's nothing to get here. The only thing you're going to get here, I guarantee you, is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man. This is the longest thing I've ever done against my will my entire life, which is why it works so well. They don't care if you like it. They just want you to do it, man. Just do it and you'll get the results. It's not always fun and games here. But I tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous turns out to be for people like me and some of the folks in here. Are you accountable and are you approachable? Are you here and can these new folks talk to you? That's all you have to be, man. Be an example that something's happened to you, even though you don't feel like it. You never know when they're laying eyes on you for the first time, man. Especially when you're in a place like this where we have our meetings. You never know when the owners are sneaking around sitting in the back row. So we want to take care of these places. May 2nd, 1982, I came out of a mission in Wilmington and the thought came to me. I came to believe, and I didn't come to believe in God or anything like that. I came to believe in the hopelessness and futility of me running my life any longer. And at the ripe old age of 30 years old, I gave it my best shot. And I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I got that guy that picked me up all these years. I said, Don, I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Come get your rusty ass down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you. And I walked that 10 miles from Wilmington to Torrance with my poopy pants and no hope. And I came to you folks and I DT'd on the ground and I fell in love with you. I have no other place to go. And after 40 some years, there's no other place I want to go. But I fell in love with the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. In that third step, it says we turned our life and our will not to God. We turn it over to the care of God. And nobody's taken finer care of me than the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.